When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Language on the Move podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Ingrid Piller, and I'm Distinguished Professor of Applied Linguistics at Macquarie University in Sydney. My guest today is Dr. Jim Hlavatch. Dr. Hlavatch is a senior lecturer in translation and interpreting at Monash University in Melbourne. And today we are going to talk about language barriers in a diverse society and how they can be bridged through interpreting between different languages. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Ingrid, and to be here on the Language on the Move podcast.
Well, maybe I should say servus and tell our listeners, Jim and I are old friends, and usually we would have this conversation in German because that's our main shared language. And so doing this in English is actually a bit unusual for us. So maybe, Jim, you can tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get into interpreting?
Well, Ingrid, it's probably not uncommon for people in my situation to have been brought up bilingually or with even three languages, but also mobility, living in different countries, being born in Australia, but then going to the birthplace of my parents when I was 7 and a half, and then going back to other places that I have relatives and friends. So spending time in Europe growing up, then coming back to Australia. So often mobility has been a factor which has accounted for my acquisition of languages and also my use of them. When I traveled again from Europe to Australia in 1995, I had done kind of ad hoc unpaid translation and interpreting work for others, and I decided I really should formalize my credentials, and so I attempted a test and passed it. So, and since then I've been a what's called a NATI. NATI, for those who don't know, it's the National Accreditation Authority for Translators and Interpreters. I'm a NATI translator and interpreter, and I work across three languages: English, Croatian, and German.
Jim, maybe can you tell us what a professional interpreter actually does? I don't think everyone knows. I mean, it sounds very glamorous. So what do you do?
I'm glad it sounds glamorous. Some parts are glamorous, some parts are less glamorous. So what you do if you're a professional interpreter is that you should have training, which I do have. You should have a credential, such as I have from NATI. But basically, when you work with other people, you're working with two or more people who don't have a common language. When you work with them, you interpret everything that they say or sign, everything. So you don't leave things out, you don't add things, you don't distort things. You're impartial, so you're neutral. You're not on anyone's side, regardless of who's paying for you. If you do have a particular relationship with a particular party, that should be declared to the other one. And you also observe confidentiality. Often interpreters work in situations where people are talking about quite personal or intimate details. And it's important for an interpreter to observe that confidentiality and to not pass on to anyone else information or events happening in interpreting assignments. Interpreters work sometimes on site, face to face with others. Sometimes it's remote via video interpreting facilities or telephone. We all know about COVID, everything went remote. So there are different modes that you can use to communicate with people. But that, in a nutshell, is what a professional interpreter does. And obviously, they have to.
So you've been stressing professional interpreter now, and I'm wondering about, any bilingual can interpret, right? So people who don't have the qualifications you have, can also go and interpret. So can you maybe tell us what's the difference between a professional interpreter and a language mediator or a language broker?
So Ingrid, lots of bilinguals do interpret. If you speak to some bilinguals, though, they'll say, I can't interpret and I hate having to do it. So it's not a natural progression. So it is something else, but you're right in that many bilinguals do, as a matter of course, do it within their families or circles of friends, whatever. So what distinguishes a professional interpreter from a mediator or a broker is the following. I've talked about a professional interpreter. So a mediator typically is someone who has a different role. They might be a youth worker, settlement worker, social worker, housing worker, or perhaps a guide at a hospital, etc., where their primary role is to do something else, i.e. to help a person find employment or housing or what have you. And they might do so using another language other than, let's say, English in Australia, which is the dominant language. And sometimes they're just having conversations in that language. Sometimes they might be working with an English speaker as well, in which case they do interpret. But they often don't know or care to know that when they work as an interpreter relaying other people's speech or signing, that they have to do so fully without distortion. They can't add their own 2 cents worth, so to speak. And so there's always an issue with a mediator that their own primary role kind of gets in the way, or they're advancing the situation of a person for settlement or housing. And often the linguistic skills that they have are questionable. Sometimes they can be good, but they haven't been tested. They don't see themselves as an interpreter. They don't know about ethics, etc. A broker is something else. A broker is typically a family member. Who is often pressed into service. Sometimes they put their hand up, but often they're pressed into service. Often it's a child who, if the parents don't speak English, let's take Australia, is there to interpret what the parents say to an English speaker and vice versa. And classic situations are hospitals, maybe police stations, other places, etc. Now, a broker is a family member. And so although they might look like a person doing interpreting, what they're doing, their primary role is being a family member. They're looking after their parent or whoever it is. They're advocating for their interests. They're making sure that what they hear and what they say is conveyed to their advantage. They're also available all the time. They understand the parent's language very well, etc. And they're also available all the time and they're free. So they sound like they're really great people to use in these situations. And often they are, but there are some pitfalls. And the pitfalls are that not every child wants to or should be in that kind of a situation. A child can never typically tell a parent how to behave, what to do, because the power relations are such that they're there to simply hear what they're told to do. There's also many cases of brokers intentionally or unintentionally changing things. Imagine in a healthcare interaction, the parent says something and the child doesn't quite understand or really fully grasp what it's about and says what they think the parent says. They convey that into English. And so what the healthcare worker hears is a description of symptoms that are actually different from what the parents said. Or conversely, they might not understand the healthcare professional properly, be too shameful or kind of shy to ask for repetition or clarification, and they tell the parents something else that they think that they've heard from the healthcare professional. And so that can lead to misdiagnosis, forms of treatment being misunderstood or not followed, to quite embarrassing situations where, let's say, an adult has a particular health issue, which is an intimate issue, and is it appropriate that the child is privy to that information, and are they really likely to convey that? And also when you think about yourself, would you like to go to a doctor and have your brother-in-law sitting next to you and you're divulging information about your medical history and expecting your brother-in-law or whoever it is to recount this accurately and correctly? And they're not going to change things that the doctor might say to them. And how does that affect your relationship with your brother-in-law afterwards, you know, if you're privy to all of these things? So we do
Yeah, look,
have.
I'm sure there are many, many difficult situations, and you've probably got a huge amount of stories to tell us. And you're not only an interpreter yourself, you're also an interpreting researcher. And a lot of the research you do is in healthcare, and you've already started us off on healthcare. And I guess by the sound of it, it sounded like you're not a huge fan of language brokering. And you pointed out all the problems that there are with family members actually interpreting for other family members. And but at the same time, we kind of know that it happens. And so I guess I'd be curious to hear from you specifically about interpreting and language mediation and language brokering in the healthcare system. What are the main barriers that patients in Australia who do not speak English or who don't speak English well, what kind of barriers do they face in accessing adequate healthcare in Australia?
So they have a number of barriers. There's often low levels of health literacy. They don't know the healthcare system in this country. They don't know what services are available or that they're entitled to. If they don't speak English fluently, then they might not know that they're entitled to an interpreter just about in most healthcare interactions that they're likely to have. If they don't know that, then they're not going to ask or ask a family member to ask on their behalf. And so the challenge is for healthcare workers to recognize that a person is unable to communicate effectively in English and to offer or to organize an interpreter on their behalf. And I've done some research, and even amongst those people who claim that they do know that health interpreting services are for free, it's often the healthcare provider who still ends up providing them. And it sounds silly or sounds obvious, but often people with so little English don't know how to ask for an interpreter. You know, they don't even have those skills sometimes. And if you haven't got effective communication, then, as you know, as a healthcare professional, they can't work out what the symptoms are, what the level of health literacy is. They can't work out a diagnosis and things like that. So
So
it is
who
a key.
actually has to ask? I mean, so you're saying patients may not know that they have the right to an interpreter, or they may not know how to ask. What's the role of the healthcare professional, or how does, if I go to the doctor, if I don't speak any English, how does it actually work that an interpreter comes in? How is that decided, and what's the process?
So the process is that if you're going to a large hospital, particularly in a metropolitan area like Sydney or Melbourne, you're likely to have front of house staff who know that this is one of the questions that they would ask as a regular feature of when they're addressing you for the first time through triage or whatever. Now, if you can functionally express yourself clearly, fluently, then they're unlikely to ask you, but they still might. So it's actually they're obliged to ask this question: do you need an interpreter, or would you what language would you like your healthcare services provided to you in? Which is the kind of optimal question, you know. So it's up to them to, and there's a lot of cultural competence training happening in hospitals. And there is a lot of information that healthcare workers learn through professional development, through their respective professional associations, how to work with interpreters. So there's a lot of skilling up that has happened across particularly hospitals. GP clinics are not so skilled up very much. I'm tracking data that's looking at the use of interpreters by GP clinics. It's lower. Aged care facilities are also lower. So we do have variation, but the key thing is often it's a front of house person to make the diagnosis. If they don't, though, the healthcare professional can make that call that this patient needs an interpreter. And so that's how it usually happens. The other challenge is that I mentioned literacy and health literacy and what have you. There's a lot of information that's been translated as well. I know that we're going to be talking about interpreting mainly, Ingrid, but here in Victoria, I'm based in Melbourne. There is the Victorian Health Translations website, which has 28,000 translations of material related to healthcare across 150 languages. And there's a lot of information out there to advise people about healthcare conditions. And one of the challenges is the discoverability of these resources. How do you get to them? They're there. You know, how does the person for whom they're intended actually access them?
I've been wondering about that a lot, actually, because they're usually organized by language, right? So if you're not, I mean, if you're not good in spelling the Latin alphabet, or if you don't know the name of your language in English, it's like really hard to find that kind of information.
It is. Typically, it's a family member, often a younger family member. I did talk about brokers who can lead them there, but they also need to know, need to know about this existing. So we do have a challenge in the accessibility of this information to people that we want it to reach. When you do get to that site, you'll find that there's not just written texts there. They're moving now to audio files as a way of conveying information to people, because we have a lot of data to tell us that this is the way people like to consume health information, not through written text, but an audio file. And there's also audio plus video. So the repository of translations in Victoria does reflect people's way of people's preferred ways of reading or gaining information in other languages. And it was also quality checked. And there's a lot of work happening recently of firstly, the translations being checked and sampled amongst communities. And secondly, when healthcare departments or healthcare facilities are looking to compose a document in English, let's say about COVID or whatever, that they actually involve translators at the stage where the plain English version is developed in the first place. And it's very helpful if you can have translators as part of the group working on them, so that when the translations are then developed, you don't have the issues of what does this mean, let's rephrase this, etc. So there is a lot of work happening in this area to optimize health translations, but we'll go back to interpreting because I know that's your focus.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, translation is fascinating too, and actually that leads me to another question. How do we actually know which languages are needed? I mean, so we can go back to the clinic. So the receptionist establishes that this person needs an interpreter, but how do they find the right interpreter? Or going back to your translations, how do we actually know in which languages do we need to make available information about a particular condition, for instance?
The big hospitals collect data on not only interpreter requests, but the languages that are being requested, and they direct their resources to employing interpreters either on in-house or freelance for those languages which are in demand. But they could have, you know, if within the catchment area of Northern Health here in Melbourne, they service residents across 150 languages. They also have data from the ABS. Every 5 years we have a census. So we do have a fairly fine-grained idea in each municipality or local government area what the profile is of the languages of the residents there, and also their level of English proficiency, because the census data does the census question has a question: if English is not your language spoken at home, what is your level of proficiency in English, right? And there are two gradings, which are not at all and not well. And when residents tick those responses, that's pretty indicative that they will be people who will need an interpreter. So we've got some demographic data. We've got data from hospitals themselves to know which languages are needed. In terms of sourcing the interpreters, yes, Ingrid, this is a challenge because for bigger languages, we do have an okay kind of cohort of interpreters to fall back on. But for new and emerging languages like Rohingya, when the Rohingyas started to arrive, say 5, 6, 7 years ago, Chaldeans 15, 20 years ago, we had to act quickly to develop testing for potential interpreters for those languages, and then getting them out to be able to work in communities. And often it's a kind of a chicken and egg situation where you kind of approach people who are community leaders and ask them, or if they know of people who have good language skills who might have been doing this before migrating to Australia, To locate people who have the attributes that you're looking for in a potential interpreter, and supporting them through training or through.
Yeah, I guess one problem also relates to like named languages, you know. In my own research, I've encountered people who said they needed an Arabic interpreter. They actually needed someone with Sudanese Arabic, but then got someone with Lebanese Arabic, and it was really, really difficult, and the interpreter couldn't really understand them. Or there have been all these media reports about the Yazidis in northern New South Wales, who speak a variety of Kurdish, but couldn't really work with the Kurdish interpreters because their brand of Kurdish was quite different. So I guess that's an additional challenge.
It is, and we do know about them. So South Sudanese Arabic, there are three varieties of Kurdish that Nati credentials. There are regular meetings, and I've been part of them, between the language service providers who are at the coalface. They supply the interpreters, and they get together with Nati, with the professional associations, etc., and say, hey, we've got this problem. We can't find interpreters for this language. We've got a high incidence of people reporting this language, but they can't understand the interpreters, or there's different varieties of Kurdish, etc. So these things are fairly quickly made aware to the people who need to know about them, and we do respond accordingly. So Australia, in through Nati, is probably the only accrediting this organization to have three varieties of Kurdish, and that's simply because, as you said, there are Kurdish languages varieties within them that are mutually incomprehensible. And the whole thing of interpreting is you need to be able to communicate effectively. If a Lebanese Arabic interpreter is unable to communicate effectively with a South Sudanese Arabic speaker, the interpreter needs to inform typically the service provider, the English speaker, about this issue, that they're unable to communicate properly, and that they need to rebook the assignment with a South Sudanese Arabic interpreter. You do have speakers that might be speaking varieties that are not your primary one. You kind of do practice you know about this very well, and get accommodation. You try and work out how do they speak. You try and avoid things that are specific to your variety. I'm often working with Slovenians who I don't understand that well, but through misallocation that happens. But if you really can't understand that, it's the onus is on the interpreter to declare this issue, and for that assignment to be booked with the correct interpreter.
So does that happen a lot? Like, you talk about misallocation. Is that a problem in the system? And then what happens? Like, if I need to attend the emergency department, for instance, maybe there is not a whole lot of time actually for people to find out what language I speak, and then, you know, to book and rebook and so on. How does that work?
Yeah, there is, it's not easy, but there is infrastructure to address this. And so if you turn up at emergency and you're incoherent or what have you, there are people who at front of staff will try and work out how much English you have. If you don't have English, what's your language? And often ask you anything, your country, or language in English, etc. So it's often possible for front of house staff to at least work out what the language or the country of birth. Now, often the country of birth does not coincide with the language, but that's at least a piece of information which is helpful for the front of house staff to start the process of locating an interpreter. The free interpreting service is available 24/7. This is financed by the federal government. It's free. So the healthcare facilities with emergency departments use this service, etc., particularly after hours, and the ability to be able to locate and get an interpreter on the other end of the phone is not bad. The waiting time is usually between 3 and 5 minutes on average, which is not bad.
That's pretty impressive.
That's right. So it's there is a fair bit of infrastructure in place to address this issue, and it people say, oh, this costs a lot of money, et cetera. But if you look at the sums, and if you look at the rates of misdiagnosis, healthcare workers not being able to communicate properly, the health effects, et cetera, and how much it costs the health system when these things happen, it's much cheaper to pay for interpreting services that address the linguistic discordance in the first place, so that...
Jim, you've got fantastic data actually on how the provision of interpreting services kind of reduces length of stay in hospital and how it reduces readmission rates for linguistically diverse people. And so really this kind of value for money that our interpreting system gives Australian society as a whole. Can you maybe talk us through that research and how interpreting really, improves outcomes for people from non-English speaking backgrounds and overall lowers the burden on the Australian taxpayer, if you will?
So Ingrid, yeah, that was data that was collected by a colleague of mine and friend, Emiliano Tsuki, based at Northern Health here in Melbourne. He tracked the use of interpreting services over 10 years. And in those 10 years, interpreting services greatly expanded, as did the population in the area. But what we had happening was, we can't quite say that it was only the interpreting services that resulted in lower length of stay in hospital and lower readmission rates. We need to do what's called multivariate analysis to be able to say that, kind of conclusively. But what we did see was that the increase in interpreting services co-occurred with these really good health outcomes, reducing the length of stay in hospital, lowering readmission rates. Those are compelling reasons. And there are also reasons which hospital managers like to see. So there is, it's not just the fact that that patients and healthcare workers can communicate with each other optimally. There are great healthcare outcomes that have occurred or co-occurred with this happening.
Yeah, that's really brilliant. We've already been talking about NATI a lot and provisions in Australia, and our listeners come from all around the world. So I was wondering whether maybe you could talk us through a bit how Australia compares in terms of provisions for people who don't speak English or don't speak it well to other countries and the interpreting provisions and translation provisions available there.
So Australia compares favorably, and I go back to really 1975 when they changed the macro social policy of Australia to introduce multiculturalism. If it wasn't for multiculturalism, the flow-on effects of that, such as interpreting services, would not be in this country to the extent that they are. So Australia compares favorably in that throughout your provision of services across health, education, defense, employment, welfare, no matter what it is, each department has to have a multiculturalism policy, including linguistic diversity. Part of linguistic diversity is the linguistic diversity of the government employees in that department, but also the people who use the services. So if you're unemployed and you need welfare assistance, then the government department that you go to has to have a policy on providing interpreting services if you require them. Health is a big area, what I've mentioned, but courts, police, defence, tourism, etc. So it's actually built in to the provision of all government services. And when you have money from government at federal and state level to support this, you can build up an infrastructure. When you don't have that government support, it's much harder, it's much less prevalent and widespread. So that's really the reason why Australia does compare favorably, and why, compared to other countries, you do find a good service in terms of interpreting services and translation.
And so you've already spoken a lot about top-down and that, the policies in Australia are really favourable and the funding situation is quite favourable. Can you maybe talk us through a bit also through bottom-up efforts, what needs to happen in institutions? Because, government can only do so much, we need the policy framework in place, but at the same time, at the institutional level, at the coalface, as you said earlier, people have to make things happen, and there has to be a commitment to, you know, multilingualism in service provision for everyone, and so on and so forth. So I know that from your research, you've also done a lot sort of at the institutional level. And so maybe can you tell us a bit about like what works and what doesn't work?
That example I gave before, when language service providers gather around a table to talk shop, to talk about what's happening, what are our problems, issues, the things we're not doing well, that's an example where people who are at the coalface do tell those people further up about what their gaps are and how they can be addressed. People aren't short of suggestions. Now, sometimes those suggestions can't always be addressed, but that's there's this interchange of people at various levels that does characterize the system here, which is pretty comprehensive. If I go back to the 1970s, though, when I was talking about multiculturalism being a key thing, there were people such as police officers complaining to their local members of parliament to say, I can't actually interview this potential witness because they don't speak English. I don't speak their language. They're getting someone off the street to interpret. This is not good enough. What are you going to do about it? You had doctors writing letters to say, I can't treat my patients. What are you going to do about it? And when the country had actually got to a stage where they knew that, okay, migration is an ongoing thing. This problem is not going to go away. How are we going to solve that problem? So there were a lot of activists in that period coming up with lots of suggestions. And that's how a lot of almost revolutionary things happened in that period. And we're fortunate we've had bipartisan support from both the Liberal and Labor Party. So both sides of politics continue to support multiculturalism. So that hasn't, you know, interpreting services or other things have not become a political football, which can affect their future existence. So that's how things kind of pan out. So it's, I'm sorry, I'm not giving you a very good bottom-up example, but there's a lot of interchange happening at many levels. And the system is kind of being fine-tuned, reviewed, and it's, you know, it is open to lots of suggestions which are forthcoming from lots of people.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's the democratic process, I guess, and it is encouraging to see it working. Now, I hear a lot of people currently coming forth with suggestions about AI and saying, you know, we won't need interpreting anymore in the very near future because AI is going to do it all for us and all those translation apps and so on and so forth. So I have to ask that question, Jim. Is technology, our language technology, is going to make human interpreting and translation superfluous?
Ingrid, what a question. It might one day, but not tomorrow or the day after. With voice recognition technology, which is the, you know, the basis for technology understanding human talk and then being able to convert it into another language, is really advancing, as we all know. We can turn on the captions function, and that will probably give a pretty good rendition of what I'm saying and what you're saying. So we're speaking English, and hopefully we're speaking standard English and speaking reasonably slowly and clearly. So voice recognition technology is good if you're speaking a big language slowly, clearly, and a standard version of it. And if you're speaking a slow standard version of another big language, you're probably going to be able to use technology that is going to, I don't know, probably interpret most of what is said correctly without too many mistakes and distortions. So the technology is there and it's improving. However, there's two things. Most of the interpreting assignments that interpreters work in this country is they're working with people who typically don't speak standard varieties, who are often, particularly in health, they might be sick, distraught, unwell, unhappy. They don't speak coherently. They don't speak slowly. They don't speak clearly enough. And so the technology is not there to be able to pick up what they're saying to reliably then transfer it into English. So for the time being, the technology is not good enough to deal with the vast array of different varieties that people use in their vernaculars when they're interacting with a healthcare worker. And there'll be a lot, you need a lot of feeding of data from all sorts of languages, including colloquialisms, dialect variation, etc., to have really, you know, a voice recognition technology system that reliably can replace an interpreter. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow or soon, but it might happen in 10 or 15 years. But it's up to also interpreters to work with this, because there still needs for many things to be some sort of human overview or at least supervision of this. So I've got a PhD student who's testing voice recognition and using a tablet and asking interpreters, do you want to take notes like you normally do, or do you want to look at the tablet and see what it's, the transcription looks like? And when you interpret, is it easy from that or from your notes? And so there are, you know, there's research happening. The other thing is, though, Ingrid, is if the technology makes a mistake and there's some sort of horrible outcome, who has liability for it? You know, if you try and contact Google Translate and say, you know, hey, you made a mistake and this cost me $100 million, can I sue you? You know, you won't get an answer probably, because it's unclear who is responsible for that transfer of recorded speech from one language into another if you use automatic or neural translation technology. So, you know, it's a gray area, but we're not going to be replaced tomorrow, I don't think.
Yeah, look, personally, I don't even think in 10 to 15 years. I mean, there is so much technology hype, and I guess I'm also interested in sort of the dangers of that belief that at some point in the future, interpreters will be replaced, because as you've pointed out, it's the most vulnerable and the most high stakes situations where technology actually fails. I mean, as you sort of said, technology is great if I need to find out, I don't know, need to get directions, if I'm a tourist somewhere and sort of in a leisurely fun situation, then it's really, really good to have Google Translate or Google Lens or whatever. But if I'm, you know, in a vulnerable situation, a high stakes need situation in healthcare, in before the courts or whatnot, I think there is a real danger actually of thinking that this leisure and fun situation is somehow going to transfer to that situation where it really matters, where we need human accountability, where we need to make sure that, you know, it's the right variety, it's all those connotations that are there and so on and so forth, as you've explained so beautifully.
Yeah, it's... things are developing, but yeah, people might think, hey, I can use it. I use it on holiday. Why can't I use it with my legal client here? You know, whatever. There are some disclaimers and warnings out there. So, for example, Optus has a particular function that you can sign up for. They can actually do speech recognition software so that you can speak, let's say, German to someone, and the other end of the telephone call, you can someone can speak Italian or Swahili or whatever. And they say this is good for general communication only. They kind of use the term general communication. They do warn that this is not suitable for health or legal or high risk situations. But it's so it's often up to people to assess what the level of risk. Particularly if there's a miscommunication or mistranslation, what the consequences of that are. So the, you know, the message is, as you said, it might be good in low risk situations or okay, but as soon as you have something where there's at stake, then you need to ask yourself questions. And human beings are a better evaluator of what risks are. Human beings do make mistakes, but they're better in dealing with high-risk situations than what the technology has to offer us at the moment. But like we say to our students, though, those interpreters who don't work with interpreters will end up without a job, but those interpreters who do work with technology can look forward to continuing to have a job.
Well, thanks a lot. I think that's sort of a good note to end on, actually. So thank you so much. Vielen Dank, Jim. And thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to our channel, leave a 5-star review on our podcast or on your podcast app of choice, and recommend the Language on the Move podcast and our partner, the New Books Network, to your students, colleagues, and friends. Till next time.